psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. As always, I enjoy having you joining me in the evenings for my show, and we are going to be traveling into a different arena of thinking this evening. We're going to be talking about a subject titled The Quantum Gate. Bill Combs is my guest this evening. This book is extremely interesting, and if you would like to have in your library something that deals with a little bit of science fiction, with a little bit of traveling, different dimensions, alternate realities, well, I could make the list go on. This is something I think you'll find very, very interesting. Now, Bill Combs is a person that loves telling stories, but he's also had a background as a researcher, and he has had a real passion for history, for mysteries, for metaphysics, and through the opportunity of writing, he has sort of brought all of these variables together, and they're extraordinarily intriguing. I want to welcome Bill Combs to the show. Bill, The Quantum Gate, and the cover of this book is just beautiful. The Quantum Gate really is such a read. It transports people from the present to the past, and then actually weaves a narrative that looks to the future. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
Bill, you as a researcher and in your professional background, did you ever imagine that you were going to be writing a book that would encompass so many different aspects of science and life and the dimensions of human experience?
Well, yes and no, I guess. No, I never thought I'd actually create a book, but I've always loved the act of storytelling and daydreaming in during my life. And so it's sort of like a wonderful, confluence where I was able to actually take something that I've enjoyed so much in other ways and bring it to the printed page.
You mentioned the word magic. When you write, do you feel that someone's given you what I would call that magic wand in the form of a pencil or pen, and that you can then create whatever it is that you want with that magic wand? Is that something that for you has been transformative?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think very much so. I mean, it works for me in a maybe a slightly different way, but for me, it allows me to, when I meditate, I tap into things and different ideas, and they will come to me, and much of the story of the Quantum Gate came to me over meditations. I have spent, many, many hours chatting with the characters, and it is like magic. It comes out of supposedly nowhere, and then I bring it into, a 3D reality by putting it on the page. But, I know myself that it's out there in some way, someplace. I tell some of my readers that, when they talk about the Quantum Gate, because it has a lot of, modern day facts and history in it, is it real? And I tell them, well, in some universe somewhere, it probably is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would concur. I've often felt and expressed to people that when there is a thought that is put out there, somewhere there is a resonance that goes along with that thought, whether it's good, mediocre, or downright ugly. Somewhere it has been in place, and there is that invisible link and connection that brings us into that environment, if you will. And when we write and we put that down on a piece of paper, it actually, in many respects, becomes a living essence, I think. Writing is amazing. That's why books are so precious. That's why they've been valued throughout history in one form or another. Now, you have characters in your book, and one of the primary characters is a man, Ethan. And there is also another man. His name is Andrew. But Andrew comes in, you sort of weave him in and out, but he still has a very significant positioning in this book. When you were writing about these two characters, both male, and then you have Maria, you have Lila, you have Sophie, you have the women that are playing a very, very significant role, and the go-between all of these characters, when you were writing about Ethan and Andrew, this to me was a very powerful association. It was an association that was built on trust, and it was an association on the camaraderie that exists in a very special way with men in their friendships. And of course, there was a difference in ages. But do you feel that some of these characters that you've written about are people that you have actually come in contact to in one way or another?
Somewhat, although honestly, most of these characters represent a different aspect of myself.
Interesting. Interesting. How did you become aware of that?
It's just when you're having conversations with these characters in a deep kind of meditative state, you can recognize yourself in them. And all of these characters had aspects of me in them. And it was a very interesting and kind of almost a cathartic process, because it's very rare that we get to have a discussion with aspects of ourselves in such a direct and transparent manner. And that was a very interesting process for me to do that.
Mm-hmm. I know I heard it said a long time ago that when you can appreciate qualities in another person, you have those qualities yourself, that often that which you detest or dislike strongly is also a mirroring of the self. So that's just a compliment to what you have expressed as well. There is tragedy in this story, and it's the tragedy that often people have experience with a loved one that is taken away. And that's Maria. And Maria and Ethan were a couple, and Sophie is their child. But there is something that's so uniquely deep in the way you were able to show that bond between the two of them. And Ethan is someone, he's really what I'd call a brilliant man, but it's more in his head rather than in his heart.
Right. Right. Yes. Ethan is, in my life, most of my life, I've lived in my head. Ethan was a reflection of that aspect of myself. Ethan's transformation, where he became more heart-centered, was also a reflection of myself after my accident that I had about 12 years ago, which kind of transformed me into more heart-centered. So he was definitely a mirror of me and even my life.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. One of the things that you begin in your book is how he is a disgraced physicist. This is someone that's in those upper leagues with people, that's all they do is they work with the quantum world, which in our time frame really is relatively new as far as the public is aware. But there have been these people that have dedicated their lives to science and to logic and to all of that intellect. And he's thrown under the bus, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Very tough situation. Very tough situation.
Right.
Now, how did, with Maria, when she came into his life, that was part of his shift, too, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I think I think fundamentally, Ethan was voraciously hungry for knowledge. And between Andrew and Maria, they brought him that tantalizing tidbit of information that he just you know, went after with everything he had, and he wouldn't let it go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the two of them, you know, were there for him, supporting him up until the accident that where he lost Maria. But it was still, if it wasn't for those two, he potentially never would have found that path.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is always interesting to me, how people will come in and out of lives, you know, where they have an impact and then they're no longer there. And yet there is that legacy, if you will, that they've left with an individual that is very significant, transforming that individual's thinking and life, really.
Right. Yeah.
And then there's the daughter, Sophie. She's very skilled, but because of Maria's death, that's so devastating to him, that he literally ignores his daughter. He just doesn't know how to get out of that space.
Right.
And
right.
Yet the evolution between the two of them, which is a huge part of the quantum gate, it's I would say, in some respects, an adventure that makes them both wake up to some things that they just didn't have any clue were going to be lying in wait for them.
Yes, it's one of the things that I'm a big proponent of is, you know, we all experience hurt and people either being there for us or not being there for us, and all these things happen in life. But one of the things that we forget a lot of is that, you know, that everybody's going through something, and sometimes they simply can't, they just shut down. They can't be there. They can't have that empathy. And so what I was trying to do with Sophie and Ethan was to begin to kind of like unwrap slowly the realization and the empathy and understanding for what each of them had gone through. It wasn't going to excuse behavior, but it was going to make it at least more understandable.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I really enjoyed about your book. It is a book that the story itself creates, I think, a thinking process for the reader.
Right.
I think that identification with what is being stated in the written form, there's that resonance that occurs. And it really does make a difference. You also bring in the term guardians. And mm-hmm. That is another dimension in the story, another dimension that is very, very old. And this is something else. You bring in all of these intuitive perspectives, but it's more than just the intuitive. It's an essence of going through, I would say, the gates of time and going backwards as well as going potentially forward. Sideways. Yes. I mean, it really is intriguing how you have folded this all together.
Well, you know what they say, time is an illusion. So I decided when I started writing the book, and definitely for the sequels, time was not going to be a constraint for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that brings forth a level of thinking that goes right along with what we hear so often in the quantum environment. There is that has become so popular, the butterfly effect, that, you know, what some person does, like a butterfly that migrates, you know, thousands and thousands of miles without understanding why that migration occurs. It's the butterfly is doing what it is, you might say, programmed to do. And it continues. There's a continuum. And it's been that way for goodness knows how many thousands of years. So your perspective and what you're bringing out in this, and how Sophie ends up finding that she's able to do this, what do I want to say, merging of time, space,
yes.
And yeah. It's not something she anticipated she'd be able to do at all.
No. Nor did she want to. She was as opposite on that path as you can get.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very much so. I mean, this, when it came into her life, just totally created something. Well, one, it created a communication with her father that's just amazing. But not only that, it's making her aware of herself in a whole new way.
Right. And it happens to many of us, too, that, you know, sometimes, in many cases, we don't get a choice when the universe comes knocking. You know, it's not optional.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's brought forth in so many unique ways. But yet there's one word that's present throughout the story, and that is the word choice.
Yes.
That is the word choice. And yep. I think that is so very, very significant because that is emphasized. And that's something that Sophie has to come to terms with. And there's a journey that Ethan is finding that he has to go to. And, of course, having this situated in Egypt is absolutely perfect because
yes.
human beings in general, especially in the Western world, are utterly fascinated with anything that has to do with Egypt.
Yep.
There is so much mystery, and I think of archaeology today and how it is discovering a lot of the assumptions that were considered facts about Egypt are proving to be very, very wrong. We are in the throes of a tremendous transition of showing that a lot of the history that we thought was in black and white actually is not that at all.
Yes, and it's been very fortuitous as it's happened the same time I published my book.
Yes, absolutely. And you bring up, on one of your chapters, you bring up Edgar Cayce. And, of course, that was, you know, he lived a number of years ago, and he talked about so much of this, which intrigued
yes.
so many people even then in his generational period. And here we are today finding out a lot of what he had seen. It's becoming very much not a myth, but a reality.
Yes, and I discovered Cayce when I was just 10 years old. My mom had a lot of his books, and I started reading them. And the story of the Hall of Records was just fascinating to a child, and it was something that I held on, you know, for many years, told myself stories about it for many years, imagined myself standing before it and opening it up. It was the fuel, the seed that literally became the quantum gate later.
Mm-hmm. And also, with this, it's dealing with a cultural environment, but you also managed to throw in a little bit in the way of politics. And that is something that is always going to be present with the human condition in one way or one form or another. And when I was looking at the very component of certain aspects in the story, I thought, my goodness, it's mirroring exactly what we're going through right now worldwide, globally, relative to leadership and divisions that are occurring that shouldn't mm-hmm. even be there, but they are due to mm-hmm. the facts of human nature. When you wrote this book, and I know you have got this is going to have some other sequels to it. And
it is, yeah.
This has so much in it. When you're writing it, when you are having these conversations in your mind with those characters that come to life and become a part of the quantum gate, when you're doing this, do you find that you are typically by yourself, or do you find that there is, maybe you're sitting and having a cup of coffee at Starbucks or a bagel at, you know, the best Jewish deli in town. Are you able to retain all of that perception so that you can write it down, or do you carry a notebook with you wherever you go?
Well, I can retain a lot of it. I've been blessed with a really good memory, but to your point, it can happen anywhere, though it mostly happens during my meditations. That's the time that I can sit down. It can be a very timeless place where you spend an hour and it might seem like 6 hours, and have lots of conversations. Things will just pop into my head and I will just follow that storyline. And when I get out of it, I have to usually go immediately and write something down.
Yes, I would imagine that that's the case. I've heard that from many different authors, that that's something that they really have to put into some written format so that they don't lose it all.
And it's not even just losing it. It's the energy of it. It's like it's in your body and you got to ground it. And the way you ground it in this case is you write it.
Yes, I've heard that too. That is something that is very, very real for many people. You're already working on your second book. It's almost ready from what you've told me. And as you are putting this together, are you finding that you're having to go through the revision process? This book, The Quantum Gate, went through more than one. And the final one that you did, which is what I have in hand right at the moment, that was completely different from what you originally wrote. So
totally different, yeah.
When you did your second book, which you are in the process of finishing right now, when you did that, have you found that there's more of a consistency of flow that has been established? It's much easier. You're not going to have to go through all the revisions like you did before?
I hope not. I would say that yes. You know, I started thinking of the second book before The Quantum Gate was only about halfway through. And so I've actually gone through revisions in my head before I even started writing. But now I have the story, the revision I have right now, the story for the second book is good. I feel it's pretty solid. It's going to need to be tweaked because it always does. You write a book and you have to kind of go back and make sure it's consistent and is, you know, everything kind of flows well. But the overall story itself, I don't really feel the need to fundamentally change it. The sequel's title is Echoes of Atlantis. And so, you know, it's going to be another one of those interesting journeys, you know, combining different things. It's going to take place differently. It's going to take place in the American Southwest, around where the Anasazi ruins are located in New Mexico. And so it's going to be a very different type of story, same, you know, basic characters, some new characters, but it's a continuation. And it's just, you know, there's a reason I call the series The Ascension Chronicles.
Oh, okay. So you have a title for the series, The Ascension
Chronicles. I do.
Yes. Okay.
Yep.
Well, that's good to know. That gives information to people that are listening that there is going to be this series that is coming up. So that is something that I was not aware of. Okay, The Ascension Chronicles. Bill, with the writing that you're doing and with this story, The Quantum Gate, being the first in the series, when you finished this particular book, what were your feelings? What was it like when you knew this one was finished, and of course you're preparing for the other one? It seems like there's, with people when they write, when they are putting together material, that there is a closure that may or may not occur. And it appears, just from our conversation, that this is not a closure for you. It is an ongoing process.
It is. I would say the first book, it was closure, and that the story that needed to be told was told. And it was closure in the essence of the opening of a much bigger tale has begun. But The second book is expanded tremendously in lore and history, and I've, you know, created, tapped into, researched an entirely different type of history for what I call my universe of possibilities. And when I write short stories and put them out on my website, I basically, they're all connected to this thing. They all provide a different lens into it. And so closure, yes, but it's also just getting started.
Mm-hmm. The door closed on the one, the quantum
on the
gate,
one, yeah.
But it's opened up for the second one and
yes.
opened up a new door. And so it's like you're just going from one scenario into the other. And that's the way life flows. That's the way it flows.
Yes.
What advice would you give to someone that wants to write? I mean, we have all kinds of subject matter and, you know, and venues that people can be in. There's the academic writers. There are those that are the creative writers like yourself. And what would you want people to know when it comes to writing?
I would say that for me, the biggest thing that really got me over that hump of deciding to write was having a friend who was an author. So having a mentor, somebody to kind of help encourage you and to kind of move you along. Many of us, myself included, for a while thought, I can never write something like this. It's never going to be that good. And so we don't realize the potential that we have. But having a good mentor, somebody who's done it before, has, you know, been in that space, is immensely valuable, and it really helped me take me from a place of never thinking I would write a novel to now I've got 4 or 5 planned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what do you think about writing groups, clubs? You know, people get together. There's different associations. What are your feelings relative to that?
I think they're wonderful. I think anything that we can do and where we're connecting with each other and that helps feed our creativity, feeds our purpose, is a wonderful thing.
Bill, you have started a journey that is bringing you into contact with so many different environments. Publishing has really changed since, you know, the 1990s, but especially after COVID and
right.
or during COVID, it changed because everything was in a lockdown. And do you find that being at conferences or being in those environments where you're exposed to different speakers, et cetera, do you find that that is something that you give very much time to, or was that something that you maybe as an afterthought were looking at? Because I think some of that is beginning to come back again.
It is, and the networking aspect of just getting with people is becoming a bigger thing for sure. Obviously, during COVID, you know, that was pretty much suspended, but I think now it's beginning to kind of come back. There's a lot of things you could do online even still, you know, with groups and people and you know, meetups and that kind of thing. But I think, you know, getting out there and meeting people is still good. I had a, you know, it's, I know book signings are kind of passe these days, but I think they're a great idea for people to do and just to meet people that could be fans and just kind of get to know them and to be there to kind of answer questions, because, you know, people who love the writings that we produce, they have questions and they would love to get some insights. And that's really, it's an important part of this process, an important part of our role as an author is to help provide that.
Well, Bill Combs, your book, The Quantum Gate, I think is not only just a great summer read, it is something that really is very provocative in a lot of what you bring forth with each of your characters. Whether it's Ethan, Andrew, Sophie, Lila, the Guardians, and there's so much more in your story. But I really think that there is that when we can share what we have learned, whether or not that person that we talk and share the information with is going to be able to use it, isn't important. I think it's that openness of communication that really makes it invaluable, as well as intriguing because we are all so unique in the way we want to express ourselves. Now, you have a website. It's very simple, BillCombs.com. That's C-O-M-B like boy, S. And they're going to find out about your writings, about your background, etc. The Quantum Gate is a gripper. That's what I like to call it. It is something that is very thought-provoking, but more than that, it's as if there is this whole new realm of possibilities that's in the era that we are in right now today as well. Bill, thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Donna. It's been a pleasure.
We are saying goodbye to Bill Combs. This is Donna Sebo. I am taking a little bit of a break, having a sip of tea, and I'm going to be back with you in just a moment. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington, 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington, 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, we've got a great lineup of people, and there is, oh, such magnificent weather here in the Pacific Northwest. Everyone is savoring it. We broke through the massive heat wave that we had for a couple of days, and it was in the 90s, which is very unusual for us this time of the year. But we have got perfect weather coming up for this weekend, and I hope wherever you are going to be enjoying the same. Now, don't forget, all of the shows are available in the archives, and the latest 13 to 15 hours of programming is promoted on the player. And any time that you just want to listen to one show right after the other, you're going to have the opportunity to do that, because the latest 13 to 15 hours of programming is definitely going to be there. And don't forget to check out the Author's Showcase, where you have direct links to the television and radio programming that I've done with different authors. And because of their support, we have been able to continue the programming, and it's a joy of mine to do. And our filming is starting in August for the next program or two for the Donna Sebo television show, and that's special editions. Now, notice that all 17 shows are already up on YouTube as well as on my website. So all you have to do is go in to the Donna Sebo website, DelphiInternational.com. Just Google my name, Donna Sebo, S-E-E-B-O, and you'll be able to link up with the videos. The YouTube is the Donna Sebo Show. That is what's going to be up on YouTube, and you'll find all the videos there as well. Well, I did want to say that there is always changes, or there are always changes coming about. And so much information crosses my desk that sometimes it takes me a while to get two different items of information, whether it be a book or an article, a magazine. I mean, there's just so many things that come into my direction because of my programming. And there's a lady that I have such a deep respect and high regard for. Her name is Joan Wester Anderson. This is a woman that she is a very spiritual lady. She put out a book, and it was Where Miracles Happen. And people submitted to Joan their personal stories. And I have to smile whenever I read any of the stories that she had. It's the type of book that you can pull out at any time and read. But you never know what's going to affect an individual. And I really have such an awareness of what people go through. Oh, by the way, the phone line is open if you wanted to give me a call. 253-582-5597. I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight if you should be interested in that. So you can give me a call here in the studio. But I find that so many of these stories, the experiences that people have, are not going to be replicated in a laboratory. And we have a doctor next month that I'm going to interview, Dr. Biteman. And this is a man who, as a physician, ended up really deep thinking about a lot of the synchronicities and coincidences that had happened to him throughout his life that directed him into an area of researching the same. Well, Joan basically did that herself in her own way. And one of the stories that she shared, I thought I would share with you. If you or anyone that you have known, could be a friend, could be a perfect stranger that you have a conversation with, the subject of addiction is sadly too often a part of conversation. It has become a plague of plagues. And it is one that, whatever the addiction might be, that can literally tear a person's life totally apart and also deeply affect the lives of the people around them. And there is this one story that took place in the 1940s. And of course, at that time, the biggest aspect with addiction is either alcohol or heroin was the hard stuff at the time. And interestingly enough, during that period, during the Second World War especially, addiction, narcotic addiction, was relatively low. I mean, it really just wasn't a plague like it is today. The reason being is that people didn't have the money to spend on it. So consequently, the drug trafficking dried up. Alcohol was the addiction of choice. Well, this is about a particular man. His name is Bob. When he was quite young, of course, there were the homemade brews. He was drinking at a very early age. By the time he was 32 years of age, he had a wife and a couple of children. He was a serious alcoholic. When his father died, his father had a well drilling business. And she said, the wife said that the husband, Bob, just missed his father terribly. And he had to take a good look at how he was living his life. Now, he already had a serious problem with alcoholism. Well, in April 1967, he stopped drinking totally. And I think it was the reflection that he did. Well, it wasn't too long after he had stopped drinking. Bob ends up hiring a very young man whose name we'll call him Pete. Now, this young man was also an alcoholic. Now, because of his alcoholism, he ended up being separated from his family. And he didn't have any place to stay. No transportation. He was working in the drilling well business. Well, Bob, because of his own personal experience with alcoholism, ends up giving Pete a job and a room. He brought him into his own home and was really supporting him in the way that you would want to support someone so that they do give up drinking. Now, Bob's daughter, her name was Chris, she really cared a lot about her father. And she said, "My dad, once he stopped drinking, really became one of the most caring people you could ever want to be around. And he wouldn't hesitate to lend somebody some money or to give them a helping hand in one way or another, because he remembered a lot of the things that he did that just almost totally destroyed his life. Well, as it turned out, the young man, Pete, just did not have the capacity to handle sobriety. The situation with Pete was a very serious one, and he never could seem to really get his act together, as we might say, and he ends up committing suicide. So his wife was a widow now, and the children had no father. Well, because of the loss of two very, very important people in his life, we're talking about Bob now, running his dad's business, taking care of the family, and controlling his own addiction, it was really becoming a very dark period in Bob's life. His personality started to change. He became depressed, didn't want to do much of anything, wasn't communicating with people. He wasn't sleeping at night. He'd pace the floor. Now, his mom, who was still alive, and his wife were very, very worried about him and took him, managed to convince him to go to the psychiatric ward of a veterans hospital that was near to where they lived. And the very day after Bob had been hospitalized, his wife got a telephone call from the psychiatric ward. And they said, "Your husband is missing. He seems to have just walked away from the facility." Well, Bob's daughter said that her dad's mom, her grandmother, was just stunned. And she said, "Please start looking for him right away. He's really going through a very dark period." So a lot of people that knew Bob and really cared for him, he had a lot of friends and various relatives, they just didn't know what to do. And if you've ever experienced anything like that, where a member of your family has just disappeared, you wonder, gee, are they alive? Are they dead? You wonder where they've gone. And Chris was very confused by what she was seeing on the behavior, you know, about the behavior of the adults around her. And she said out loud, "Why is everybody so upset?" And one of the relatives, because she was just a little girl, they asked her, you know, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, you're all so upset. Why?" And of course they told her, "We cannot find your father. We are very concerned about his well-being." And a child, and sometimes children, come out with the best statements. She said, "I wonder what God is for. All you have to do is tell him about it." And the adults just stopped and looked at her. She said, "What I just said, out of the mouths of babes." She said, "You're absolutely right." So everybody that had been so anxious, they all got together and they formed a prayer circle and they started praying for Bob. Well, Chris, the little girl, when she was a little girl, went to bed, curled up underneath the covers. She thought about her dad. She said, "What does it matter if others thought him lost?" She said, "God knows where he is." And so she had a personal conversation. Yes. She said, "God, I want to pray for Daddy, and that's all I can do. You got to take care of him now. I'm tired, and I'm going to sleep." That's a 6-year-old's logic. Well, it was a few hours later. Then hospital officials actually found Bob. Where they found him was not in a very safe place. They found him wandering on a 4-lane interstate highway several miles from the institution that he had been put in. No money. Nothing that gave any kind of identification about someone to call and nowhere. He didn't know where he could go for help. The people that had observed Bob on this very busy freeway said Bob was deliberately moving to the middle of whichever lane had oncoming traffic. and was so out of it that apparently what he wanted to do was to be killed by a car. It was as if he was trying to commit suicide. But interestingly enough, he was never hit. Carves, the people driving the vehicles, saw him, swerved around him, then just kept on going. They'd slow down and swerve around him and be on their way. Chris said that when people wondered, was he hallucinating? What was going on? When they got him back to the hospital, they said he was mentally ill, and they started to give him treatment and put him into a very safe environment. Now, he responded very well to the treatment and ended up going back to the family, and his life was back to what you would call normal. But Bob and his daughter had had a conversation. And, of course, remember, she was a little girl when all of this was going on, just 6 years old. The two of them, in having a conversation, said there was more than doctors and therapy that enabled Bob to come back to what would be the healthy self. He told his daughter, he said, "I was never alone while I was on that highway. It was very dangerous. There was a lot of traffic." He said, walking on either side of him was his father and Pete, the one that had committed suicide. They were both alive and healthy. They would talk to him while he was out there wandering on the freeway. They said, "We've come to protect you, Bob." And that's what they did. He said they shielded him from speeding cars, helped him to get over his feeling of loneliness, and stayed with him until help arrived. The interesting thing is, Chris said this, "My dad never saw his father or the young man he had tried to help that committed suicide ever again. But he said, you know what? They were with me because they told me that you had prayed for me and I was to go home. You are going to be okay," they said. These kinds of stories, when you hear them from people, stories that have changed a person's life, a person's thinking, that does not come out of a test tube. That is not something that you're going to ever typically experience a second or a third time, at least not in the same script format. Many times we go through experiences. You can call them synchronicities, you can call them coincidences, whatever term you want to use. But the truth is, there's a lot to life and there's a lot to love that can create miracles. That when you experience those happenings, you sort of change your mind about a lot of things. And one of the most important and significant parts of that change is that you understand you are not alone. And there are those that will be by your side in one form or another. And it does make a difference. I know, because I've experienced that myself. And so often it is easy for people to say, hallucinations. They do not know what they're talking about. Mm-mm. No way. They are not going to know until they have an experience themselves. And that's the reality of it. That's what makes, I think, stories like Joan Anderson collected so very, very special. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. Many times we will think it's better just to text someone, or we don't understand how valuable writing is. Now, you listen, if you listen to my show on a regular basis, you hear me talking with authors that write in all kinds of venues, academics, science fiction, fiction of all expression, horror, whatever it might be, nonfiction, all kinds of stories from people around the world. This shows you how important communication is. The written word is also very powerful, and sometimes in a most unusual way. Now, Robert Muldoon Jr., when his dad passed away, he was, well, it just was really quite meaningful to him, which is not a surprise. But he said one of his habits that his dad had is that he would make lists. This was something that he did, and he did it for the last 25 years of his life. And he loved books, absolutely loved books. He had a shopping list with the books that he wanted to read and that he would eventually get. He was what I would call a man who made lists for everything. And he had little pocket-sized notebooks, and he had a special reading chair. And those notebooks would be stacked very neatly beside him on a small table, and he would choose the one that he wanted to do specific lists in. And he said, until my dad died in 2004, and cancer is what stopped him, he said that's what he did. Well, when he passed away, Robert scooped up all these little notebooks that his dad had written in, and he put them in a box. And he said one of the things he noticed, beside all of these little books that had book lists in them, he had what he called his green book. And he said he didn't ever look through them really too much. And he said, of course, I got busy and I had to take care of family and responsibilities. But he said, my dad's history was that he grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts. He was born in 1927. And he said, my grandfather worked in a tannery that took cow carcasses, their skins, and turned them into leather. And he said, his immigrant grandfather had worked in wood mills. And he had grown up in the community of Lowell. And he said it was a wonderful environment to have a family and to raise children in. And he said, my dad was just extremely intelligent. And he didn't want anything to do with what his father and his grandfather had been involved in that type of work. Now, he graduated early. Robert's dad did at 16. And went on to college, and then he joined the army. So he was pretty busy just being what I'd call a normal young man of his era. And he said after he'd served his time in the military, he was able to go back to college. And he said, my dad got a master's of science in physics. And he was doing all of this. He'd commute from the community of Lowell that he'd grown up in. Well, his very first job as a young person was in 1951, and he was an engineer in a ballistic research laboratory at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland. But he got homesick for Massachusetts. So he heard that there was a business, the Watertown Arsenal, was hiring. He made a call, and he talked to the woman on the phone, and before he hung up, because he wasn't getting very much positive enforcement, he said, I am a physicist, and I'm looking for work. And she said, well, for heaven's sakes, why didn't you say so? We're hiring physicists. And so he ended up becoming, Robert's dad did, an expert in what was called the Fortran. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it was a computer programming language back in the 50s. And he worked for a number of years at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology at their Lincoln Laboratory. and he moved his family to Boston. But, you know, he still was homesick for the community that he grew up in. And he said, you know what? That environment was very, very important. But he'd do some things with his son. And he said, my dad was never one of these people that wanted to travel around the world. And when we'd have conversations, I would ask him about, gee, Dad, wouldn't you like to go to England or to China or take a ship around such and such an area of the sea? His dad said, no. He said, I read. He said, I absolutely am happy with my life. And he said, my dad's just very sedentary. And he was absolutely in love with his lifestyle. He was very, very happy. And he said, you know, there is something very special about life. There's always changes. And even when he was in the hospital before he died from cancer, he was making lists about things that he remembered. And on the 20th anniversary of his father's death, he said, I decided to look in the Green Book. And he said, I was amazed. My dad had cursive handwriting because that's what people were taught. And he said, it was amazing what my dad put in the list. He said, my dad never ever left that reading chair. But what he did do was recall what life was like in the community of Lowell that he grew up in. He said, my dad was a very rich man. He was rich inside of himself. He said, he was remembering so much of what was a part of his time frame, his era, his generation. And because of that, I was left a legacy of the world that he lived in. And these are just a few of the things. And this was the very last list in the Green Book that he found. Doctors making house calls. Remember, he was born in the 1920s. Robert's dad was. Funerals at home, wreath on the door. We had tobacco baseball cards, parades with Civil War veterans, buying gas by the price. A dollar's worth, that filled up the car. Nickel hamburgers and hot dogs. Penny candy, 6 for 5 cents. Weekly rent. Ice delivery, icemen. Milk delivery in glass to your front door. Glass bottles, in fact. For heating, coal bins. Barbers that would give shaves to the men that they gave haircuts to, and they'd use a straight-edge razor. Tailors, shoemakers, everywhere. Horse and wagon deliveries. Troughs for horses. Ah, yes. Not everybody had a car. But when you went out, you got dressed up. And so many other things that he remembered. And, you know, when I came across this story and I was reading through the list, I thought, sometimes it's a very good thing to go back and to see how people's lives were in different generations. It's not good, it's not bad. But just to be aware of the progress that has been made, and in some respects, well, we've lost some of the things that maybe they had. But to be aware of what made life rich and full for millions of people in that time frame, dealing with all kinds of challenges, wars, etc., and they still had a very rich life. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul, no matter who you are, no matter where you are significant, and you make a difference. God bless, be well, and hey, it's a beautiful weekend. Enjoy. Take time to talk to a friend. Be good to yourself. Why not savor a good read with a good book on a warm summer afternoon? Donna Sebo, bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.